Hi, everybody. My name is... And when Daddy gets done, you better get up and run. Hi, everybody. My name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you guys for inviting me out to be with you. It's good to be in here. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people here that love me. Of course, they're not here tonight, but they'll be here. And it's good to be in a meeting. There's a lot of friends here and stuff, and people I've known over the years. And I want to thank you for inviting me to come and be with you. I'm glad to be out of my car, out of Victor's car. Actually, away from Victor. Victor picked me up at the airport, and the first thing I asked him was, how you doing? Victor just stopped telling me about 5 minutes ago. And if I wasn't thoroughly convinced, he came to my room and talked for another half hour. So. But I've had a good time here. He's a good man, and he seems like he's been in good hands here. And I want to welcome the new people. Good to see you here. Boy, you really look convinced when Betty says you're on a sure road or something like that. And he goes, "You bet." So far, so good, ma'am. I had the privilege of talking at the Spring Fling here about five years ago, and came down here in a hurry. I was late for that meeting, too, and got hooked up with some Mideastern cab driver by the name of Mayhem. Remember that? Yeah. And, I landed in Oakland, and I said, "I got to get to Sacramento. I've got 2 hours to get to Sacramento." You know, "I've never been there." You know, and I said, "We're going today, pal." You know, and I drove. I said, "You look at the Thomas guide. I'm driving." You know, "I've never seen it before." You know, and but I got there on time, and I got up there, and I changed, and Betty and about five other women helped change me for that meeting, and. The only thing she kept saying to me is, "I love candlelight meetings. Do you?" You know? So anyway, it's the reason we're here tonight is to find out just what the hell these people are up here, right? The judge and jury, huh? And of course, I'm not afraid to introduce my name, and it's good to be in a meeting of alcoholics. If you're new, I want to let you know that my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 20 years and not amount to a damn thing. So you're on the right track. If you're new, get yourself a sponsor. And if you don't know what one is, keep it that way. years ago in the racing industries, the cars were going so fast, the dragsters were going so fast that the front wheels were leaving the ground and killing the drivers. And so the engineers and the guys got together that designed these things that go on the back of these dragsters called spoilers, so that no matter how fast this dragster goes, the front wheels never hit the ground. They never leave the ground. Hence the name sponsor. You know what I mean, Victor? No matter how crazy you're getting in AA, and you will get goofy now that you're sober. Believe you me, the fun is just starting. Because you'll spend the rest of your days in sobriety trying to open that curtain that, "Oh shit, there's life, oh shit," you know. But get yourself a sponsor who doesn't care how goofy you're getting, but will ask you kind and loving questions like, "Well, where were you last night?" You know? And that's the way my sponsor is. He doesn't care how goofy I am, because he knows that comes with the package, you know. But he's concerned with where I'm at and what I'm doing, you know. And you're not going to shock us. You know, I used to think that my life would shock my sponsor, especially when you're taking you're going to take your fifth step. I remember, you know, I got all this stuff, and Jesus, God, you know, the guy's going to throw me out of the car, you know. And then after you're done and he shares some of his stuff, you're going to throw him out of your car. You know? Wipe off that seat, you know. And get yourself, and you know, there's nothing more hard. Get yourself a couple guys that you're going to get sober with. You know what I mean? Because there's nothing more heartbreaking than to see people trying to get sober and hang around their old chums. You know what I mean? Get a couple guys that you can talk to about your sponsor. You know, and see if that guy is as mean to them as he is to you, you know. But the idea is that when one guy's goofy, you can pull him along, and when you're goofy, they can pull you along. But for Christ's sake, at least you're pulling each other to the same place, you know. At least you're pulling them to Greenwood or wherever, you know, your meeting is, you know. No, I don't want to go. But, cross that off the list. Mr. Letty, no home. So, but and get yourself a couple guys that you can get sober with, you know, and find yourself a home group and get ready for a journey. It is going to be a journey, and find yourself a nice home group and stuff like that, and dig in. You know, Dr. Bob said that if you put half the effort into staying sober that you did getting loaded, you got a good chance of it. You know, that's for that day. You know what I mean? There's a myth in Alcoholics Anonymous going around that the longer you stay sober, the least you have to do. You know? And that's not so. You've got a progressive disease. This is now your connection. This is where you go to stay sober, because the ugly disease, alcoholism, strikes the alcoholic when he's sober. You see? And it doesn't, and you know, the great obsession to the alcoholic, the obsession to drink never comes as a form of a drink. It always comes as a form of, I don't need to do this no more. I've got my 2 years. Let somebody else make the coffee. You know, people in AA don't get drunk just like that. They work at it. They back into it. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, oh, I mean well. You know, I can't make that home group. I gotta get work boots tonight. How cunning and baffling the disease is. If you're new, you've had people telling you your entire life, you better not drink. You shouldn't drink. Don't you drink. And nothing could be further from the truth for alcoholics of our type. If you're new, you're gonna drink. You're gonna drink. Know that. If you don't do something about this merciless disease, you're going to drink, because if it was any other way, you wouldn't be here tonight. Alcoholics have tried every imaginable remedy. I have tried it, and nothing keeps the alky in check. I was at a meeting where it was a question and answer meeting not too long ago, and a guy asked me, what did you learn from your last drunk? Not a damn thing. Alkies don't learn nothing. They don't learn a thing, man. That's what normal people do. They, oh, Jesus, I had a 502. I ain't doing that anymore. You know, I gotta poop my pants. I gotta knock it off forever. You know, I woke up with a strange person in a strange town. Hell, that's the best part of the whole deal, man. Hang in there, you know. Jesus Christ, you know. That's what normal people do, man. Normal people just swear off forever, or they get a good job, or they find her, and they, you know. Not that alky, man. That alky will have chunks of liver, poop in his pants, and he's banging on that door. Can I have a bottle of half pint of that bourbon, please? You know. He don't learn his lessons, man. We don't learn lessons, man. Normal drinkers spend one night with that alky. And I go, Jesus Christ, I don't want no more of that. Not that alky. The alcoholic wakes up at 3 in the morning waiting for 6 in the morning to come over. You know, keep banging on that, you know. That's the way we are. We're alcoholics, man. Sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time again. I couldn't stand the way that I felt that I was sober, you know. And you know, the idea of coming to AA didn't put on a warm glow. You know, I mean, oh good. Oh, this is going to be fun, you know. I understand what you said, you know. This is going to be neat, you know. Let's see how long this lasts, you know. And because everything was a matter of time with me, you know. And then when I would get sober, it felt like such a waste of time, you know. It felt like I was just wasting time. And then I would get drunk to make up for lost time. Even if it was just a week, baby, I go, boy, I just wasted so many hours, man. We can't stand to stay sober, man, you know. And so Alcoholics Anonymous will do something about that state of mind that drove you to drink. And that is the nature of Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't a place where you come and get sober. It's where you learn how to live now that you're sober. And the big deal isn't raising your hand and admitting you're an alcoholic. That's not what our first step is about. It is admitting that you're powerless. That you don't have the power to stay sober. You don't have the power to get anybody else sober. You are powerless. All you've got to believe is that it's a matter of time. I'm going to drink. I am going to drink. You know, I am going to drink. You know, Father Dowling, a good friend of Bill Wilson's, once told him that, you know, they talk about in AA that there's no dictators. Don't you believe that? There's one in Southern California right now. No, but there are two dictators in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you ask anybody about that that's been sober a while. One is the Father of Life that says you are welcome to do my will. And the other is whiskey that's saying you better damn well do his will. Because I'll be there waiting for you, pal. I'll be there. You'll never get so sober that you can't drink again. You will never get so sober that you can't drink again. But you can get so drunk that you can't make it back again. You know? It would behoove you to do these things. But you've got to be convinced. I can't convince you. A tape can't convince you. Where's my burger? You know? And that's what that first step is all. Being convinced. We are now at step one. This is the first step in recovery. And it says we got to look right in here. And I couldn't identify with anybody. I didn't identify with Bill Wilson, some stockbroker. I didn't identify with the butt doctor. Who are these guys? You know, a little bit of envy, but you know. But then, now how do we get convinced? How do guys like us get convinced? By coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why identification is so important. You have a little bit of convincing on your own. But that's why it's so important that when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about alcoholism, because even though you've gotten it, some people are still trying to identify here. And that's what this thing is all about. One alkie talking to another. Sure, I'm an alkie who did a lot of drugs, but I suffer from alcoholism. That means I can't live without drinking, and I can't stand sobriety. And there's no middle of the road answer. And that book tells us that no one likes to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live a spiritual way of life. There's no middle of the road answer. And I spent my whole life trying to find that middle of the road. There's got to be an answer. Why? Because when I'm sober, I'm crazy. That can't be the answer. I have been sober. Our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about the doctor's opinion. And it says that the only answer we have is entire abstinence. And then that following paragraph, it says, this starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. You bet, pal. I've been sober, and that's not an answer. There's that not drinking crap again, you know. I want sobriety with occasional drinking. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. Oh, how I love to try to control it, you know. Oh, yeah, I'll know when that phenomenon of craving, I'll just sneak up on it with a couple shots. I'll feel it coming, and then I'll take off. You bet you'll take off. With three women out to Palm Springs, you'll take off, man. You know. They look like women. It's a whole other talk. I And I come from a good home. My mom, I was born in Detroit and I came over here when I was about 4 or 5 and brought up in a little foster home. And my mom was a little Scandinavian and she loved speed. You know, she loved those diet pills. She loved to buzz around the house around midnight and sort out nuts and bolts all night. You know, run out into the garage and just clean shit. You know, and sneak and grab the edger and do the whole block. You know, what is that, a cat fight? Let's go find them. You know, she'd be off and running, man. You know, and just always on alert. She was always on guard duty. You know. And she loved to needlepoint. She loved to just click and clack all night long, you know. And everything had an afghan. Everything had a... Chairs had afghan. Couches had afghan. My dad's golf clubs had little chipmunks in it, you know. If there was any animals, they had a fresh vest, you know. And just buzzing along. Everything was powder blue and yellow, you know. And she loved to do jigsaw puzzles. Her hobby was doing puzzles, you know, these 30 million piece puzzles of Indio, you know, and she'd go to Savon's and get her carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had the coupons, and she saved the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know, and one that I know you know about, you know, and she'd get that stinky peroxide. It was all purple and smelled like sewer gas. And she owned one muumuu her entire life. And it was starting to get shiny in some of the wrong places, you know. And get out of the sunlight, Mom. I don't want to see that shit, you know. Not my mom, you know. And she'd get this puzzle, and she'd take some more speed, and she had these big pair of toenail clippers, because if she got a piece that wouldn't fit, she's going to snip that son of a bitch right down. We got a job to do, you know. Frame it and put it right over my bed, you know, with the rest of the unfinished puzzles, you know. And just a busy lady. And I had the feeling, I just constantly had the feelings of an only child. You know, however, my two sisters disagree, you know. I didn't talk to them, you know. They were busy running from my mom. Every now and then I'd see a sister go by the dinner window, you know, and my mom's chasing them, you know, because she's going to pop their blackheads, you know. You know, I don't know what the hell that's about, you know. So they were always on the run, you know. My dad was a great guy. My dad was a happy drunk. He was a refinery worker. He was a happy World War II Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin singing the blues drunk man. He loved to drink and he just loved to sing, even though it was just one sentence of the song all night long, you know. And just a happy drunk, a miserable man when he was sober. And my dad didn't have keys to his own front door. That bothered the hell out of me, because he was not always sneaking in my bedroom window drunk, you know. And I could feel that old greasy refinery boot coming in there around midnight, you know. And I remember grabbing it one night and I said, "Hey, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? You know, hell, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going right now, you know." Oh man, I knew my mom loved me. I knew my mom loved me. There was no mistaking about that. And I loved the fact that my mom loved me. But it was my old man's attention that I wanted. I wanted that guy's nod of approval from day one. Why? Because I didn't feel like a man. I was a scared kid, and I didn't want to let him down. I didn't want him to know that I've got this ingrown laziness, and he is reeking of responsibility. He's the kind of guy that just, he was born with a lunch bucket, you know. You know? I mean, he was just, and he used to tell me, "You don't know what it's like to be poor, you know, back when I was your age, you know," and he would take me back there, you know. And it was true, because he had a hideous childhood. His mom hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. His dad choked on his tongue at a young age, and he spent his young teenage years doing side work to bring up his kid brother. And he had a dream. He met this lady in high school, and his dream was to go to World War II and come to California and live that good life. And that lady was my mom. And they were childhood sweethearts, and they were solid, you know. And he reeked of responsibility, and I was so afraid to ask him how to do things. I wanted just to come to him and have the answers, you know. I wanted to impress him, you know. And I didn't know how to ask him to do things, and I didn't know how to tell him how goofy and lazy and just goofy I felt, you know. And around 11 years old, and I'm doing everything that all the other kids are doing. You know, I'm not holed up in my closet, you know, watching Oprah or nothing. You know, I'm a busy, goofy kid. I'm playing with frogs and, you know, and stuff like that, and playing baseball and stuff like that. But everybody seemed to be content with everyday living. Everybody seemed to grasp and develop a manner of living with ease and comfort. And man, I'm grinding. I'm fighting to feel good. I'm doing all these other things, you know, and I do them well, you know. But man, I don't feel good about it. I'm always questioning who I am. I'm always got this little bit of fear. I got my dad promised me that in 9 months I'm going to have a baby brother, and I start saving up those baseball cards and oiling up my glove and thinking about this kid brother I'm going to have. And 9 months later, my dad comes in that bedroom and tells me that my baby brother died. And the first thing that goes through my mind is I didn't have any ounce of compassion for my mom, but I went right after the old man with all 70 pounds, and I took a swing at him, and I started yelling at him that he promised me, you know. And he became the top of my list when I did an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my first resentment. You promised me, you know. And I tell you, it put in something with me that carried with me up until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is nobody explained to me what happens to you when you die, or that little concept of life, because I'm a kid and I'm thinking I'm living forever. And nobody explained to me about that, what happened. And I got this tremendous fear now that what kind of goofy life is this where they create you and kill you? You know, you better be on the lookout because they're going to come and get you next. What kind of God is that? I don't want to get close to any kind of God, and I didn't. And I tell you what that does to a lazy person. That whenever you start putting 10% into something, you start talking yourself out of things. Well, what's the use? I'm going to die anyway. What's the use? What's the use of getting sober? What's the use of going to high school? What's the use of, and I would have dreams, and I would talk myself out of these dreams, man. I would have little 11, 12-year-old ambitions, you know. Yeah, I'm going to be a cameraman. And then I'd talk myself out of it. What's the use, man? You're going to die anyway. Screw it. And that's all a lazy guy like me needs. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a lazy man's guide to success. I guarantee you. I flat-ass guarantee you, man. It is. I have spent my whole life giving 150% at just doing 30%. You know what I mean? I've really given it my all to be an all-time loser. You know what I mean? And when you're a loser like me, people start bringing people to your side to compare you to. Right? Come on, Victor, why don't you try to be like Bob? You know, what? And this happened to me in high school, man. I'm in high school, and I'm a freshman. I get drunk. I'm in the principal's office. And I'm sitting in the principal's office with my dad, and my dad sees this guy's picture up there. It's the star quarterback. You know, my dad's an old football player from Michigan. He says, Jesus Christ, Larry, why don't you try to be like Coy? My sophomore year, I'm getting arrested for being loaded on Reds and drunk. I took the janitor's cart and I drove it through the library doors. You know, I had to get that book back, you know. And I'm sitting in the principal's office with my dad and my probation officer. And the probation officer says, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know. My junior year, I'm at home and my sister starts dating this guy and she brings him home. And who is it? Old number 7 right there on my couch, you know. My mom says, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know. My senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days. And I look at the Daily Breeze newspaper and it says, Coy makes all pro CIF. And I said, Jesus, I'd like to be like Coy, you know. Well, I'm about 7 years sober, and I'm in my little plumbing van in downtown L.A., and it seems like nowadays that it's vogue that on every street corner, somebody is going to be selling oranges or peanuts, or they're going to have this goofy sign that says, "I'll work for food," like you don't, you know, and... Why not work for sex? You know, make it worth your while, for Christ's sake, you know. And so, and everybody's trying to save me. I'm always getting pamphlets and born-agains and stuff like that coming up to me. You know, "You look like you need to be saved," you know, and "Not today," you know. And so I'm at the stoplight, and this guy locks eyes with me, the guy with the sign. He locks eyes with me. Then I go, "Oh, shit." You know, I got $2 and he ain't getting it, man, you know. Sure enough, he locks eyes with me and he comes over to the car and he goes, "Larry? Larry Thomas?" And I go, "Coy." I thought that guy had it made, you know, and I thought, shit, if there's any justice in AA, maybe my sponsor could send him a letter saying, "Why can't you be like Larry?" You know? You know that's going to happen, you know. Yeah. So I've got this pitiful laziness going on, and I've got this force that's telling me, man, you've got to be responsible, and I don't know how to do it. And I'm restless, and I'm irritable. I'm always fighting to feel good, and I'm talking myself out of that, and I can't sleep at night. I'm always up watching Jack Parr or Johnny Carson rocking. I'm a rocker. I love to think. I love to think now. I've got a head that's got so much power, it could just run a boat, you know. I wish I had much physical energy as my mind has energy, you know. I would just... just nonstop, you know. It's just unbelievable, man. I could be physically tired. I talked in Washington last weekend, and I am physically beat the next day, you know. And so I figured, oh, I'm going to have a good night's sleep. So I lay down. 3 a.m, my head wants to chat. "Hey, Larry. You alone?" You know. Not in my head, you know. Take a number, goddammit, you know. "Hey, I want to chat. Let's, you know, I want to chat." "No, it's not small talk. I want to bring you up to date. We're gonna talk about when you were a kid and bring you right up to date, you know." I'm going, shit, we just did that the night before, man. It's a rerun, you know. It never stops, you know. And it never has enough energy to talk about good stuff to me, you know. My head, when it talks good stuff, is like a butterfly going by a window. "Yeah, you're going to have a good day. You turd, that's there for 23 hours, man. You're no good son of a bitch." You know, just hammering me, you know. And, you know, but around 11 years old, sobriety stopped working. I had about enough of it, you know. And I said, "Jesus Christ, man." Me and 4 guys went across the street in a garage, and we capped a still of 4 Rose whiskey. And I guarantee you, man, I didn't have to fight to feel good anymore. It took a little howdy doody and turned him into James Dean in 2 drinks, man. I loved it. 2 drinks and a boy. You know, shit, I was ready, man. "Come on, baby, I'll kick your ass," you know. And God, I just felt good, man. I just, man, this is all right. That was the best I'd ever felt, because I had never had anything in my little 11-year sober life make me feel that good. Not a good grade, not a home run, not, you know, mom and dad's. I wasn't lacking for love, but nothing made me feel so complete. And that's what I sounded like when I took my first drink. Exactly. Oh, yeah. And I looked forward to it. It was like the more it burned, the better it felt, man, because you knew it would just burn out the gooey stuff, just the weakness in you. Just, yeah, baby. You know, I just, oh, yeah, your eyes start feeling good, your eyes get bigger, your hair gets bigger, you know, and yeah, you know. And I love the effect produced by alcohol, because it produced something in me that I couldn't produce on my own. I tried, and I never could produce what that shot of whiskey could produce. And I didn't go to Skid Row that next day, but I got the address. Put that in my Palm Pilot, let's see, you know. And And it was always close to me. I it wasn't hard to find. I didn't have to hang out on the streets. It was in my garage. It was underneath the disposal. It was all over the place. I brought it to school with me, and I loved it. It was going to be close to me. And I knew even at 11 and 12 that I'd be leaning on this stuff for a long time. I knew it would have to be close by, you know. I seen what it did for Dad, and I seen what it did for me, and it can't be all that bad. You know, how can anything that makes you feel that good be that bad? You know, and I found a group of people when I was a freshman in high school who I just fell into it. I started hanging around these little Mexican girls, and they introduced me to their brothers, and I started hanging around the lowriders. And I love the lowriders. We used to get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know, and lower our Chevrolets, you know, and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my little plumbing truck about 3 months ago when the Four Tops came on. I just start, Jesus, shaking my shit, you know. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Loopy, and she curled her hair up real big, and I'd get my hair up real big, and we'd bounce around all night looking, what the hell are you looking at, baby, you know. Oh, yeah, I loved it, man. My eyes got bigger, my hair got blonder, man, and we'd bounce around all night and get those little frowns on our face because our ass hurts, you know, and I loved it, man. I loved the effects produced by alcohol, and I loved these guys, and I knew we were going to live forever like that, and I remember every now and then you got to do something to get into the gang, and some guy stole a jar of Reds, and so we were all going to go get this guy, and we're bouncing around after this guy down Whittier. We're going to get this guy, and there's about four of them in the back seat, you know, and we finally find the guy, and I'm thinking these guys are going to help me. We're going to stop off, and we're just going to get this guy. And I've got this pipe and this magazine, and I'm drinking. I'm going, yeah, man, we're going to do this. And we're getting all juiced up and ready. They pull into the lot, and the guy's in the back of the lot, and he's a Samoan fella. He's about six foot nine, 390 pounds, you know. His feet are this thick, you know. And they let me out of the car, and I'm thinking these guys, you know, we're going to go get them, you know. And I don't know about you, but anything that happens in fast, anything good is just fast motion. Good things are just clicking by. Anything that's bad goes in slow motion, you know. And I could tell something was going on when it clicked into slow motion. As I'm running after this guy, and I see that I'm all alone, you know, they're driving off, you know. Adios, whatever, you know, and like that. And I'm chasing after this guy, chasing like he's running from me, right? Come on, son bitch, you know. And I'm running after the guy, and I think I'm going to hit him with a pipe, right? The pipe falls out of the magazine. Now, me and Mocha Java, I'm going to kick his ass with the Life magazine is what I'm going to do, you know. You know, and that guy kicked my ass for 4 days. I'm seeing chunks of liver, you know, and the only thought that I have is, you know, when he's done, I'm going to kick his ass. So, get it over with, pal. You know, and I ran into a kid like that not too long ago, a couple years ago. I'm in the Glendale Mall. This kid walks by me. He's about 19 years old. He's all bald. He's tatted down. He's got a tank top on. He's got these big pair of pants that you know, put about four kids in there, you know. He's got five beepers because he's an important kid himself, you know. You know, and I walk by him, and his ear is pierced. He's got a ring in his nose. He's got a ring in his lip. He's got a chain to his wallet. It looks like they're all hooked together. He looks like a goddamn science project, you know. I walk by him, and he goes, "What are you looking at?" And I says, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know." He's got a ball bearing in his mouth. I'm thinking he's going to start up any minute now, you know. Now I sponsor the guy. He calls me dude. Hey, dude. My name's not dude, you know what I mean? He says, "What do you want me to do?" I says, "Unlock yourself, for Christ's sake, man. Grow some hair, you know. I know what that's about. I know what that's about. It ain't about being bad or anything like that. It's about keeping them out. You know, Alky spent a lifetime of keeping people out, man. Well, pierce our face, we'll get our hair up like a rooster, we'll do all kinds of things. We'll even have intellectual disguises, you know. But it's about keeping them out. Just whatever little image you can come up with, you know. People do it when they come to AA. come slippers. That'll keep them out. My case is different, you know. And then when you run out of images, you have your ace in the hole, which is your anger. What always seems to keep them at an arm's distance. You know, and going through my inventory, you know what I always, you know, I always had somebody, I was always involved with somebody. I always had a relationship of some kind because I always needed somebody there so that whenever I was in between drunks, not necessarily getting sober, but in between drunks, because you know it's going to wear off, that I could always have a human being to have an argument so I can leave and get drunk at them. See, if you live by yourself and get drunk at the world, they'll think you're crazy. It's good to have a human there, you know. And that's all people were in my life. That's I am a user. People were just there to be used. They weren't there to be loved or nurtured. They were there for obvious and unobvious reasons. But they were there to be used somehow by me. You know, to either make it appear like I've got a decent life or just someone to be selfish with. You know what I mean? There was no honor in my life, you know. But I got out of high school and not really, but around 1969, a lot of people are going different places. Some of them are going to Vietnam and some of them are going to San Francisco, and I wonder what I'm going to do with my life. And so me and my buddy went to Detroit to find my roots, and we wound up in Phoenix. And you know, and I wound up over at North Central in Roosevelt at the Apache Motel overlooking the Wagon Wheel Bar. I've got a $40 a month room, and I get to share the TV with everybody. You know, it's down in the lobby, you know, and I'm looking out my window and I'm drinking and I'm dying and dreaming. That's all I ever did. Take a drink and just stare out that window and wonder what the hell's going on and come up with these little ideas and then talk myself out of them. Just constantly talking in and talking out in a matter of minutes, you know. Going to Volt and going to Manpower, getting the high-tech jobs. And I got a job with this this one plumber, and I got fired from that. And then I meet a guy over there at the Wagon Wheel Bar, and his name's Ernie. And Ernie's an idea man. He's from Tennessee, you know. He says, I know how we're going to make some money. Really? He says, yeah, not too far from here. There's a horse track. We're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. All right, Ernie. You know, and I figure I'm going to be into training and stuff like that, you know. He says, what we're going to do now, we got 2 months to get you down to 95 pounds, Ace. And he says, and then we're going to get you down, we'll take you and get your colors and all that. All right. He says, now I need you to take this stuff, you know. And he gave me a bag of mess, you know. And then he, you know, I'll be back in 2 months. Well, he came back in a week, and I'm in the same doorway. I'm going faster. Come on, faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life, Ernie. You can put a saddle on me and ride my ass anywhere you want, you know. He said, you couldn't have possibly taken that stuff, you know, and it was all gone, you know. And when you get to that point, you know, anything that's falling on the floor, you're smoking. Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, there's a toenail. Fire that thing up. You know, I know there's some shit on there somewhere. You know, and 108 pounds. I'm almost there, Ernie. Come on, man. God damn it! Don't quit me now. You know, just wild. So we got rid of that idea, and I went over and I got another job with this with another plumber, and I'm digging this ditch, and I fake a knee injury. You know, and they take me to the hospital, and I get a prescription for Percodan, and I meet these guys at the bar who live in Tucson, who know some doctors in Nogales, and we start writing things writing prescriptions for Seconal and Obitol and Nembutal and Tylenol and you name it all. We wrote it all. Just damn near took it all too, you know. It was just wild and. So we moved down to Tucson, and after about a year or so, they caught up with me. And caught up. You know, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase. You know what I mean? There he goes, down to 605. And none of that shit happening. It's like the sheriffs come to your motel room, and they go, Oh, hey, he's under there. I ain't coming out, you know. And so, God, you're all holed up in the closet, you know. And always butt naked, too, you know. Something about Alfie's being butt naked, man. You ain't blacked out till you're butt naked in front of Grandma, you know what I mean? I don't care, Granny, you know. I spoke out at Bakersfield about a year ago at their Friday night, and we were the convention was sharing the hotel with Jehovah's Witnesses. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I had this secret desire to get up one morning and go pounding on all their goddamn doors and saying, "Hey, you know Bill and Bob love you, you know." Just to see how many of them answer the door butt naked, you know. But wouldn't that be great, you know? Me and my friend Victor here, you know, we've been riding bikes all over this damn neighborhood, you know. Who are those two guys? They're the same two guys in whatever neighborhood you go to, huh? So they locked me up and they convict me and they put me away for about a year and a half, and in 1974, they give me a $45 voucher and send me to the Continental Trailways, and I come back to Los Angeles, and I go to the L.A. courthouse, and I sign up down there, and drinking began to be a necessity and no longer a luxury. That's all I can tell you, is that you are just in a place where you are even getting the idea that maybe you should stop. You're buying the idea, finally. You finally buy the idea. Okay, hey, you know what? Man, you're right. I can't do this again. And you run under that illusion that a lot of us run under, and you hear it today in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes about hitting a bottom. You hit a bottom, goddamn it, and it just catapults you, you know? And if you hit that bottom, if you get down low enough, well, that'll just turn that alky around. Not if you're an alcoholic of my type. Where, see, I'm a bottom feeder, you know. Yeah. I hit a bottom and I set up house. I don't learn from that, you know. I'm thinking I'm gonna learn. I'm thinking, yeah, man, I can't go through with this, you know. And I finally buy the idea, you know. Yes, I want to get sober, and I put my little feet on the ground, and I'm not gonna drink. I mean it, man. I've had it. I can't drink anymore. I know what happens to me, and it scares me now. And I know I gotta stay sober. And so I try to stay sober on my own. And I'm not gonna drink. And I start making promises to people and even myself. And the book says, no matter what the necessity or the wish, that means whether you think it's necessary or I do, whether you're wishing and me wishing, that no matter what the necessity or the wish, it's gonna wear off. And I'm going to drink. And no matter what the consequences, no matter how many teary eyes, no matter how many chunks of liver, no matter what the deal is, it's all going to be pushed aside when you're sober. Because you can't stand the way that you feel when you're sober. And your mind don't care that you're sober. You're an alcoholic. It's thinking, come on, baby, who are you kidding? You're going to die anyway. You may as well do it with VO, pal. You may as well go down singing. You know, and you buy the idea that maybe this time, right when I get to that point of no return, I'll catch myself. Or maybe if I just stay in this room, you know, and just lock the door, just me and Old English, you know, just stay there, you know. But there's got to be another answer, because sobriety's not it, you know. And in 1974, I'm stone cold sober for 2 months. I'm on Anabuse. And now my sobriety is getting scary, because when I'm sober, I'm getting into this place that feels like a bad acid trip, and I feel like I'm going to get locked in there. And I'm being arrested over at a Little League dugout on a Sunday afternoon for being caught in between hysterical and maniacal, and I can't get out. I'm a case. And they take me over to the Harvard General Hospital over there in Carson, and they see that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts, and that maybe I need to go to a state hospital for a month to be observed. And they sent me to Camarillo, beautiful Camarillo, and 11 months later I come out of there, totally observed. You know, ain't nothing to see here no more, you know. And they gave me my bag of antidepressants and antipsychotics and anti-anxiety pills, and they said, you know, you run out of this stuff, champ, you're going to be in trouble, you know. And they gave me some psychiatrists to see and some stuff like that, and they were right, because at about 2 months I ran out of Thorazine, and I got drunk. The voices were so loud, and the reality was so grim. Reality's always been grim. To the sober alcoholic, there's nothing pretty about reality. It strikes up everything while you're drinking, you know. And in 1975, they picked me up over there in Alvaro Street, publicly intoxicated, a violation of probation. No big-time convict, but just a little punk loser, street merchant, street urchin, you know. You know? And they send me up to Wayside, and I'm up there at Wayside, which is a county jail farm, and I'm up there for about 30 or 40 days, and they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus, and they send us back to the South Bay Courthouse, where I'm going to be tried and convicted. And 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm in a little holding tank about half this size, and I'm the only one in there. There's just me and bologna sandwiches. All the buses are gone, you know, and I'm just sitting in there with my Vons bag going, I wonder where they're going to take me now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch stuck his head in a jail cell. And he says, "Hi, lad, are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "My name is Alex." He says, "Come with me, you're going to AA. AA? Those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's an AA, you know? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? "Hi, lad," you know. Some kind of river dance promotion or something, you know. You know. And so I'm ready for a long ride and maybe some lunch, you know. And this little man had me in his car for 15 minutes. It was a lime green Plymouth. And for 15 minutes, this guy was your biggest cheerleader. He talked you up a storm. He had your enthusiasm here tonight. He was happy about the fact that he was sober. You see, he didn't have to be there. It was his day off. And he's hanging around a jailhouse, you see. And he was so happy he was going to bring me to you. And if you knew, he told me something that I always try to remember to pass on, because we know you're new and we know you feel different. We know you feel different. And that has been my problem. No matter who's in front of me, I feel different. That's the mysterious barrier. The barrier isn't color. The barrier isn't money. The barrier is that no matter who's in front of me, I'm afraid of them finding out how I think, and they won't understand a damn thing I say. That's the barrier. And this guy told me something. He says, "I know you feel different." But he says, "I want to tell you something, Larry. In Alcoholics Anonymous, and only in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." You feeling different? Welcome. Welcome. If you are new and you're happy and you're well adjusted, you may not need us. Al-Anon meets down the hall, you know what I mean? But you see, we get happy and well adjusted after certain actions. You know, not just from not drinking. Not drinking has never promoted good mental health for me. But a series of action called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous seems to promote an alter in our thinking and our behavior, where for once sobriety seems to be comfortable enough to live in, where you're not such a bad guy after all. And that man had me in his car. In 1975, he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to a little club over there in Torrance called the TLC Club. He introduced me to a little lady named Indian Jeannie, and Captain Bob, and Tennessee Bill, and Singin' Sam, and Serenity Sam, and Bicycle Ray, and Santa Claus Ray, and Dancing Feet, and Whistling Butt, and all these other people, man. I said, my God, I just left a group of people like this, you know. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo, you know, and Little Moose came after me like a little toilet paper commercial. She, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are." I said, "I'm not it, you know." And then this transvestite came out of the card room, and he started circling me like a helicopter. You know? And about his third time around, he said, "You know, I'd like to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, give Betty a call, you know. I said, I don't think so, you know. Not till I get a year anyway. You know? But that's a great dress, you know. And I said, my God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of this, you know. I don't want to crack that book open, you know. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk. The longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. Take the edge off. And you know what? And that's the biggest lie that I've ever told myself, if you're new, was that I was coming in and out of AA. Now, that don't make me a better member or a worse alky either. Some of us wear that slipper shit like it's a badge of courage. You see? All that does is prove to us that this way does work. You see? But you know what was going on with me, and I didn't realize this till long after I got sober, was that I was doing the same thing in here that I was doing on my little motel room by myself. I came to these meetings and conceded my innermost self that I was alcoholic, and I said to myself, I'm not going to drink. Now that takes some kind of power. That takes some kind of will on the alcoholic. And will wears out. It'll eventually wear out no matter what room you're sitting in. I never once got the idea that I'm going to drink and I better do some things. It was always up to me, the egotist of the alcoholic. I've got to do it. Now you see, I had a secret. The reason why it became a project for me to do it was that there was nothing in me that felt like a man. Nothing reeked of manhood in my life. Oh, I used to think anger and violence was a sign of manhood. I used to think this phony image of machoism was a man of character, but all it is masquerading fear. It doesn't take a man to yell at his wife and bounce her around and cuss and curse people. There's nothing manly about that. I had no idea what was in store for me. And I never don't stay sober. I never once applied this program to my life. I never let another man in my life called a sponsor. What a great thing it is to have a sponsor. What a great thing it is to be a part of this thing called alcohol. I never wanted to get close. You see, because I had a secret, and that is this. Maybe if I stay sober on my own and learn a little bit about this stuff with you, that maybe I could stay sober, maybe that would make me feel like a man. And maybe then I could talk to my dad. Because I don't have nothing to offer. And what you had was somebody coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And in 1980, I'm over at the Don Hotel over there in Wilmington. I'm on the third floor. I've got a hot plate and a hot TV. I got a PM bourbon bottle, and I got it cut in half. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot. You know? Every now and then you get one right. You know, Donald Duck. Yay. I don't need no college. I got GED. You know. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, I heard this. Larry, it's Don. Oh, my God, it's that guy from AA. Man, I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here now. Larry, can I come in? Oh, yeah, yeah. Open the door. He's, oh, my God, what happened, kid? You had 15 days. You were going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you. We got it all here, baby, you know. And he says, what's going on, kid? You had 15 days. And I said, Don, I says, I don't want what you have. I took a hit off of that bourbon bottle and I said, I don't want what you got. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Just get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to do. Just get the hell and just leave me alone and let me do what I want to do. And it struck a chord in the back of my neck that shot me back to 1967 when me and my dad are fighting and I'm getting kicked out of the house at 15 for selling dope. And he's telling me, you want to live like that? Go ahead, but you're not living here. I've got two daughters and a wife. And I start after the old man and I start slugging him and I make physical contact with my father. A shame that I will never, never drink away. I don't care how much I hate him, I could never forgive myself for striking my father. It reminds me of 1972 when the Macho Man's coming out of another institution, and where do macho men go when there's no place to go? They go to mom's house. Ain't that right, guys? Yeah, mom, yeah, I love you. You know, and the Macho Man's on mom's couch, and like the days of Wine and Roses, I can't find my whiskey bottle. And I start tearing up her house. I start tearing up her little house. I go through her medicine chest. I go through her kitchen. And I look for a bottle, and she comes down the hallway, and she says, "Honey, what's wrong?" And I said, "Don't you, honey, what's wrong with me?" I start smacking my mom around until I get blood out of her little nose, demanding that she come up with a bottle that she had no idea was around. For me to wake up that morning and see that it was in the trash can. You see. It reminds me of the countless times . Here's the kind of thing we're dealing with here. This is the kind of selfishness we're dealing with. We're not talking about stingy. I want to talk about what you have up in front of you tonight. And that is, there was one time in my life where my mom hadn't seen me for 2 years because I was put away and living on the streets. And I come to see my mom, and she's over there at the dry cleaners where she worked. And 50 yards away, I've got my street mud on. And I lock eyes with her. And she hadn't seen her son for a long time. And the only thought that I have is that woman better have $2. Now, you take the same man and bring him to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sees the secretary of a meeting 50 yards away, and I'm supposed to ask him for a commitment, and I can't do it. That's the kind of selfishness we have here. There was no thought process in me abusing my mom. It was an automatic thing. I didn't need a program. I didn't need people talk me into it. I didn't need a sponsor. It just came like that. But get me to ask a guy to have a job in a meeting or do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have got to be beaten down. I got to go to 10 meetings a week. I got to write about it, pray about it, you know, have all this motivation just to ask something to do in a meeting. That's the kind of person you're dealing with here. You see? And that man left my room, and for 2 years I'm stuck with the memory of you. I can't stay sober, and I can't get drunk, and I got the memory of that bald-headed carpenter. I can't get him out of my mind, you know. And for 2 years I'm living on the streets, and I'm destined to live on the streets, and I'm living the alcoholic nightmare where the nightmare is not that he's getting drunk, but that he keeps coming to. And he knows it's just a matter of time. And on May 2nd of 1982, I go by a Woolworth's window and I catch eyes with the thing, and the thing's 125 pounds. He's yellow. He's got two cuts over his eyes. He's got his hair down to his shoulders. He's got his Goodwill clothes on. His shoes are tied to his pants. And I look at myself in that Woolworth's window like I'd never looked at me before. And I said, "My God, whatever happened to my dreams? Whatever happened to that kid that could run like a deer? I had so many hopes and dreams and stuff like that." And I got what I always did when I got that way. I thought, I panhandled some money and I called AA. I got a hold of central office, and who do I get? I get Don. "Hey Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you come and get me?" And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, "No." He says, "You know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to get sober, get your rusty rear down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you." He said, "The sign says we care." He says, "I'll be damned if I'm going to take care of you." And he hung up. I said, "My God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know?" And I took the longest walk of my life. It was about 10 miles from Wilmington to Torrance. And I waddled down to that club. And I got my little poopy pants and my dirty street mud. And I walk up to the door. And they say, "What do you want? You've been banned from the club." And I said, "Well, if it interests you, I'm looking for Don." They said, "Well, he's in the back over there. Go see, but you got to leave when the meeting starts." And I waddled up to that guy, and I asked that man something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't ask him for a dollar, and I didn't ask him for a ride. I walked up to him, and I asked him something. I said, "Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor?" And that man lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. And then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. I gave that man a 27-year cape this morning. I gave him he was my first sponsor. I left him when I was a year and a half because I got complacent. I got to be a club guru. I seen where I was, and I seen where I'd become, and I knew there was no further work necessary. I knew where all the dances were, and I knew some quotes out of the book, and I knew just enough to be dangerous. I was living on slogans in AA. I was living off the junk food of AA, and my alcoholism was demanding meat and potatoes, and I didn't have anything to feed it. And so what it does is it starts getting thirsty. And I'm sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at 2 years sober, thirsty. And I'm coming to these rooms, and I'm restless and irritable and discontented. And I'm seeing guys stand up at the podium with ties like this going, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. And I backed away from the sponsor, and I started keeping secrets from the sponsor, and I started judging that sponsor, and I started hating that sponsor, and I started getting thirsty, and I backed away, and a man came down to me and told me what I was at 2 years sober. He says, you're a taker, you're a loser. He says, there's a program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says, I hope to God you find it. And I followed that guy. And that guy's my sponsor today, and he took me to a home group. I'd never had a home group. And I love my home group. My home group's the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. My home group is my home. And I hope your home group is your home. And what I mean by that is that you've got people there who know how you live. And you have jobs in those meetings. And that is some place where you are accountable for 3-4 times a week. People know you. You know? And it's my home group, and I have chores in that group. You see? And I welcome you at my home group, and I help get you coffee, and then I thank you for coming. Now, the reason why I have chores at my home group, because that's my home. When I come to your home to visit, you're not going to ask me to clean up the bathroom when I leave, are you? You know what I mean? This is my home group. I take care of it. If you'd like a job, you're welcome. But that is the atmosphere that was created for a guy like me to finally get comfortable in and get sober. It is my responsibility as an AA member to recreate that atmosphere. I hope I never commit the sin of coming here and getting and see you later. I hope I never get that complacent. You see, if you're new, watch people here. Watch them like a hawk. And what you'll notice is people coming up at this podium and taking cakes for 1, 5, 6, 10, 15, 20 years. And they will talk to you about their blessings. They will talk to you about how they've been blessed with this job and how they've been blessed with this home and how they've been blessed with this career. Watch them like a hawk. Watch them. 90% of them start hanging themselves with their great blessings because they become more concerned in taking care of their blessings than the room that blessed them when no one will. And their priorities get out of whack. And they think that because they're crazy, they need to go someplace else to take care of this. When the answer to sobriety and the good life is the same solution. It's God's great privilege to give you His kingdom. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and great things will happen. Put all your energies into staying sober. Keep your hands off your personal life and watch it bloom. Watch them bloom, but watch what happens to you the moment you take your eyes off AA and you start focusing on your personal life, and you'll see how restless and irritable and this AA shit don't work and I don't care what they're doing, because you're not taking care of your primary purpose. You take care of your primary purpose, good God will take care of you. It may not be in that next day, but the man is taking care of you. Come here and help take care of his kids. That's where the work is to be done. That's what I had to learn. I had to learn that I had to earn a living, that there was no magic wand in AA. Bless this guy, don't bless this guy. You know, he's got the job, she don't got the job. It's about getting out there and earning. Going out there and the book, Bill Wilson talks about it on page 14. God will help us, AA will help you survive the certain low spots that lay ahead. He's telling you there's going to be low spots, but he's telling you you're going to be able to survive them. If you stay close to us, hunker down with us, we'll help you survive everything that will happen to you. You get your hope by listening to us. You get your faith by weathering the storm. Anybody can leave when the shit's hitting the fan. But when you stay here and everything in you says, I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going. Victor's going to be there. Larry's going to be there. I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going. Hi, my name's Larry. I'm an alcoholic. Let us train your feet because your head don't care. Let us train your feet. And just like when you were drunk, how I just automatically went to Eddie's liquor store, every now and then your head's going to automatically take you to your meeting. And you can't shut off your head. Quit trying to shut off your head. Just put it in the back seat like a mother-in-law and get to your meetings, you know. Every now and then, you know. But get here. Because once you're here, we'll quiet the head. You'll get the rest of these goofy people, and you won't feel so different. And they'll pass the basket, and they'll read chapter 5, and you'll see the countdown. And you start to settle in. But at least you're with us. At least you're with us. See, you'll create a fellowship that you crave. Now, there's a word you understand. We'll help you create that fellowship. And I hope you stay with us. And it's been my pleasure, you guys, to be with you. I get the pleasure of going home to a wife who's sober in AA. And God, I love this lady. She's 10 years sober. You know how I know she loves me? She don't need me for a damn thing. She's got a good job. She's got a car. She don't need me for nothing. She still hangs around. I think I will stay here and learn how to love her. I didn't automatically love her when I first met. I didn't have the ability. But I said to myself, I would sure like to learn how to love this lady. I would sure like her to be that one. I would sure like her to be the first lady I've never cheated on. I would like her to be the lady that I tell other ladies about. And that's what she is. And I've got a daughter that I'm not supposed to see that I see on a regular basis, I was telling Victor. Because if I can go to Sacramento, I can go to Phoenix and see my little girl, which is more spiritual. And my little Lauren is just doing fine. She's a 15-year-old piece of work. My biggest fear is that I'm going to see her on Girls Gone Wild. Just, you know, my God, there's that birthmark, you know. She's doing so good. She called me up the other day. She says, Daddy, she says, the kids are making fun of me in school because I'm so smart. She said, did that ever happen to you? I said, you bet. Happened to me every day. Now, what are you going to do with a guy like me? I don't know nothing about living. I've had to learn it from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you guys made me a plumber. You took me out of the gutter and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sake. I've been doing it for 10 years, and I enjoy my life. I got a job that I love. I got a wife that I love. I got a life that is exactly what you promised me. You see? I don't need to go anywhere to get nothing done. I come here and I take care of my sobriety. Everything else gets done because I'm powerless. But I've tapped into a power called Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor tells me that it's God's great pleasure to give you his kingdom. And believe you me, you folks have introduced that to me. Thank you so much.